It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Britain and the United States warn Russia of broader sanctions if it disrupts Ukrainian presidential vote. And reports say Nigeria's president may visit the town where girls were abducted. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and British Foreign Secretary William Hague say the United States and European Union will hit Russia with far tougher sanctions if it tries to disrupt next week's presidential election in Ukraine. British Foreign Secretary William Hague addressed reporters on Thursday.
We say in our communique that this mocks the innocent lives lost in the conflict, utterly contradicts the Geneva communique. It is a parody of democracy. Many millions of Syrians will be unable to participate in such a so-called election, and we call on the entire international community to reject these illegitimate elections.
And Secretary of State John Kerry spoke after Mr. Hague.
Let Ukraine vote. Let the Ukrainian people choose their future. And let them do so in a fair, open, free, accessible election.
You can follow more about this story at voanews.com. There are conflicting reports about whether Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan will visit a northeastern town where Islamist militants last month seized more than 200 schoolgirls. Senior government officials told reporters Thursday that Mr. Jonathan will travel today to Chibok village in Borno province before leaving to attend a meeting in Paris. But later, the coordinator of Nigeria's National Information Center, Michael Mary, told VOA that report is not accurate.
I am not sure of the reports and its sources. As coordinator of the National Information Center, I don't have that information. Therefore, I doubt its authenticity.
The April 14th mass abduction of the girls by the Boko Haram group has sparked global outrage. Nigeria's government has said it is exploring all options to win the girls' safe return. President Barack Obama has dedicated a new museum in New York recounting the horror of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks in the United States that killed nearly 3,000 people. The American leader Thursday recalled the heroism of rescue workers who helped save thousands of people trapped in the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center after Al-Qaeda hijackers crashed passenger jets into the skyscrapers.
To all those who responded with such courage, on behalf of Michelle and myself and the American people, it is an honor for us to join in your memories, to recall and to reflect, but above all, to reaffirm the true spirit of 9/11.
Families of the victims and rescue workers gathered for the dedication at the National September 11th Memorial Museum, located on the footprint of the World Trade Center. The $700 million museum and memorial plaza are set to open to the public next week. The medical charity Doctors Without Borders says five of its workers have been freed after months of captivity in Syria. The group, known by its French initials MSF, announced Thursday that two of the captive aid workers were freed Wednesday. The other three were freed last month. Doctors Without Borders closed one of its hospitals and two medical centers in northwest Syria after the workers were abducted in January. There is outrage in Turkey after newspapers printed a picture of an aide to the prime minister kicking a man protesting the mine disaster who was being held on the ground by police. The incident happened in Soma on Wednesday during a visit by Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Is already under fire for appearing to be indifferent to Tuesday's coal mine blast in Soma that killed at least 282 people. The prime minister had called mining accidents ordinary things, but he added the entire country is in pain and promised a thorough investigation. Turkish President Abdullah Gül visited Soma Thursday and vowed to do whatever is necessary to prevent future mining disasters. And a court in Sudan has sentenced a pregnant woman to death by hanging for refusing to renounce her Christian faith. The judge also sentenced the woman to 100 lashes on charges of adultery. Under Sudanese law, marriage between Muslims and non-Muslims is not permitted. Any such union is considered adultery. For more on these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. From Washington, Bill Michaels, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Will Nigeria's president visit Chibok today, where more than 200 girls were abducted?
I am not sure of the reports and its sources. As coordinator of the National Information Center, I don't have that information. Therefore, I doubt its authenticity.
Mike Omeri is coordinator of Nigeria's National Information Center. U.S. lawmakers examined U.S. response to Boko Haram abduction of Nigerian schoolgirls. South Sudan's government makes international appeals to end sanctions. And who's leading in polls ahead of Malawi's May 20th presidential election?
The election in Malawi is too close to call. But that said, there is a clear candidate that is in the lead, and that is the leader of the Democratic Progressive Party with 27%.
Boniface Dulani is Afrobarometer's operations field manager in Malawi. Tensions mount in South Africa miners strike, and the World Health Organization said people are living longer today than in 1990. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There are conflicting reports about whether Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan will today, Friday, visit the northeastern Nigerian town of Chibok, where Islamist militants last month seized more than 200 schoolgirls. Senior government officials told reporters on Thursday that Mr. Jonathan will travel to Chibok village in Borno province before leaving to attend a meeting in Paris. But Mike Omeri, the coordinator of Nigeria's National Information Center, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the report is not accurate.
I am not sure of the reports and its sources. As coordinator of the National Information Center, I don't have that information. Therefore, I doubt its authenticity.
Where do you think this information is coming from?
Well, that is what we have been faced with since this incident started. Lots of misinformation has been going on there, both local and international. And Nigerians out there who are not part of what is happening at home are really feeling agitated and worried. But we have so many of such stories, even in some of our local newspapers, that are not true.
So what are you specifically doing about this as the coordinator in the president's office?
A direct response to it is the establishment of this National Information Center. What we have done is to ensure that the streamlining of information and to serve as the only credible source of information to the people available and put in place by the government of Nigeria. So what happens here is that every other agency engaged in this activity channels their reports and outcomes to this center.
What is the government specifically doing about this abducted girls, especially when the government and the president have come under withering criticisms about not doing enough?
Part of the misinformation has led to the kind of accusation and allegations against the president and government of Nigeria, and that is unfortunate. The government is doing its best within the capacity that it has at the moment. It has mobilized troops and has a division of the Nigerian army with two battalions stationed in the area and working assiduously with citizens. The government is also mobilizing citizens to be aware, to be security conscious, and to participate in the task of arresting this insurgency because, as you know, 80% of insurgency worldwide is fought by citizens.
Tell me, what has been the cooperation of all these international experts who have come to help the government to search for these girls? Some people are even speculating that some of these girls have been broken into several groups and spirited away into neighboring countries.
We don't subscribe to that view, but the international partners and support are being briefed. They are meeting with respective security agencies and other organs of government. They have been debriefed to engage in the game.
What information are you putting out there concerning this, what you described as misinformation, both locally and internationally?
Well, essentially, let all of us direct this campaign at the insurgents, because that is a problem for Nigeria and it's also a problem for the world.
Mike Omeri is coordinator of Nigeria's National Information Center. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. The Obama administration says it is helping to rescue more than 250 Nigerian schoolgirls abducted in mid-April, but that effort is encountering challenges and obstacles. As VOA's Michael Bowman reports, U.S. officials testified on Thursday on Capitol Hill, where lawmakers uniformly condemned the Islamist militant group Boko Haram.
From widespread protests to a borderless social media campaign, the schoolgirl's plight continues to grip the world's attention. U.S. Senator Chris Coons heads the Africa panel of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Boko Haram is trying to send a message, and the world, starting with the Nigerian government, must respond by saying their crimes will not be tolerated and perpetrators held accountable.
Appearing before the panel, the Pentagon's point person for Africa, Alice Friend, said 16 U.S. military specialists have been dispatched to advise Nigerian security forces. She said the threat posed by Boko Haram is growing and has exposed other problems in Nigeria.
Nigeria can be an extremely challenging partner to work with. In the face of this sophisticated threat, Nigeria's security forces have been slow to adapt with new strategies, new doctrines, and new tactics. Even more troubling, Nigeria's record of atrocities perpetrated by some of its security forces during operations against Boko Haram have been widely documented.
And insecurity in Nigeria grows against a backdrop of hunger and need, according to Earl Gast of the U.S. Agency for International Development.
It is projected that by 2015, Nigeria will soon be home to the largest number of persons worldwide living in extreme poverty.
The international community has rallied to provide assistance, but there is much Nigeria must do on its own, according to Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Robert Jackson.
The state must demonstrate to its citizens that it can protect them and offer them opportunity. When soldiers destroy towns, kill civilians, and detain innocent people with impunity, mistrust takes root.
The kidnapping crisis has sharpened U.S. lawmakers' focus on the safety and well-being of women worldwide. Senator Jean Shaheen struck a resolute tone.
We can either allow women to continue to be victims of violence and ignorance and repression, or we can act on behalf of our wives, our daughters, our granddaughters.
A bill before Congress would make the safety of women a U.S. government priority in its dealings across the globe. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
South Sudan government officials are calling on other African governments to ignore international calls for sanctions on a select group of South Sudanese officials. As Lucy Pony reports from Nairobi, the official says sanctions will only make it harder to achieve peace.
Government spokesperson Michael Makuei-Lueth called a news conference during a visit to Nairobi to encourage regional support for President Salva Kiir's administration. He says the government should be guided, not condemned.
We are saying region, stand firm, support the democratically elected government. If there are any mistakes that had happened, then you don't beat a child because he has broken a glass.
The United States has called on regional countries to consider imposing sanctions on South Sudanese officials who have contributed to human rights violations or are obstructing ongoing peace talks in Addis Ababa. Earlier this month, the U.S. issued sanctions against Presidential Guard Commander Mariel Chanwong and opposition military leader Peter Gadet, freezing their assets and imposing travel bans on both. Officials have warned more sanctions are possible if a cessation of hostilities agreement signed last week is not upheld. Makwe says such sanctions only make it more difficult for the country to achieve peace.
The international community and the people in New York go in and say these two parties have violated the agreement and they must be sanctioned. How do you sanction them now when you have not verified who has gone wrong? To me, that is a hasty decision that does not need to be taken at this moment.
Makwe says, despite the sanctions, the government is engaging in the ongoing peace dialogue, including discussion about an interim government. But he says they will not budge on one point.
The position of the government is very clear. If you are going in for any type of government, it must be led by Salva Kiir, who is a democratically elected president. Not the rebel leader who decided to rebel against a democratic system.
Makwe says he's not planning to visit any other countries in the region to talk about the sanctions. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 16th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. newsnet.com. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. A newly released Afro Barometer poll in Malawi shows President Joyce Banda and her ruling People's Party in third place behind two opposition presidential candidates in a run-up to the country's May 20th presidential and legislative elections. But ruling party supporters say the poll's findings could negatively influence prospective voters as well as lead to potential voter apathy. Boniface Dulani, Afrobarometer's operations field manager in Malawi, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the scientific poll is a true reflection of the responses of Malawian voters in the run-up to the election.
Our main finding, you know, is that the election in Malawi is too close to call. But that said, there is a clear candidate that is in the lead, and that is the leader of the Democratic Progressive Party, with 27% saying that they would vote for that particular candidate if the election were held at the time the survey was done. In second place is the Malay Congress Party leadership, and that's Reverend Lazarus Chakwera, with 21%. In third place is the incumbent president, Joyce Banda, with 19%. There's also 15% of our respondents that thought that they were not decided at the time. So we believe that depending on who that 15% decide eventually to vote for, that could sway the result in favor of the top three candidates in particular.
The poll will come under some scrutiny by those who feel that they should be at point A or point B. Some of them have said that this is not representative of what Malawians are looking forward to. How do you react to that?
Well, Afrobarometer has gained the reputation of doing these surveys, not only in Malawi, but in 35 other countries on the continent. There is a lot of credibility, and we stand by our numbers. Of course, I think no one, especially this close to the election, would want to be labeled as a likely loser. But I think what we always tell people is that, look, I mean, it's not Afrobarometer saying that this one is in the lead or that one is in the lead. We are just really presenting what Malawian citizens have told us. So the onus is on the political leadership in this country to go and make a case to the Malawian citizens that they are worthy of getting their vote.
Critics of Afrobarometer in Malawi are saying that being so close to the election, this will negatively influence and that this could possibly undermine the credibility of the election on May 20. What do you say to that?
Of course, I mean, it's always going to be good timing for everyone. But again, this is what Malawian citizens are telling us. It's not Afrobarometer saying that so-so is going to win. So if Malawians themselves have already decided.
Boniface Dulani is Afrobarometer's operations field manager in Malawi. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. South Africa's largest platinum producer tried and failed to break the nation's largest ever strike this week with an attempt to lure miners back after 16 weeks. The head of the union leading the strike urged workers to stay firm as tensions rose in the mining town of Marikana. Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
The strike in South Africa's platinum sector has gone on for a record-breaking 16 weeks, making this the longest and costliest strike in the nation's history. Led by the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, the walkout has halted about 40% of the world's production of the precious metal. The union shows no signs of giving up, with its leader urging those thousands of members to stay strong and maintain the union's firm demand of a basic wage of just more than $1,200 per month. That is the same amount AMQ asked for in 2012 when it was a minority union and launched an illegal strike against lawnmen, in the process gaining members from the then larger National Union of Mine Workers. That nearly two-month strike reached fever pitch on August 16th of that year, when South African police shot dead 34 striking miners. This time, police spokesman Tulane Ngubane said the scene in Marikana was peaceful, but was visibly annoyed when asked what police were doing to prevent a repeat of the 2012 violence.
We don't have a crystal ball. We don't know what tomorrow holds, but we are doing our work to the best of our ability, and what we're doing is we flooded the area with police.
Ngubane said there were no reported incidents of violence, but the head of the rival National Union of Mine Workers, Franz Baleni, said his members had been intimidated.
We are concerned about the current instability, especially violence. We condemn the current violence whereby some workers' rights are being violated.
This time around, it appears to be a game of attrition, with the workers caught in the middle. The economy of the town of Marikana, which surrounds Lonmin's mine, has withered noticeably as stores have closed and many of the 70,000 striking workers have returned to their rural homes. AMQ officials did not respond to repeated calls Thursday seeking comment about their strategy. The three main platinum producers affected by the strike, Anglo-American Platinum, Impala Platinum, and Lonmin, have bypassed the union and approach the workers directly with offers of pay raises of up to 10%. None of the three platinum producers or their media representative responded to several calls seeking comment. But the three said this week in a joint statement that they want the strike to end, and their offer directly to workers was fair, affordable, and sustainable. The ongoing strikes have also served to underscore the deep inequality that continues to plague this mineral-rich nation. The strike has also prompted President Jacob Zuma to accuse the union of being irresponsible and to call for miners to return to work. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A new report by the World Health Organization finds that people are living longer. The WHO's annual statistics report shows that people are living an average 6 years longer than they did in 1990. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The World Health Organization report finds low-income countries have made the greatest progress, with average life expectancies rising by 9 years between 1990 and 2012. WHO Department of Health Statistics and Information Systems Director Thies Boerma attributes the improvements to major successes in the health-related Millennium Development Goals.
Child mortality is 47% down since 1990. Maternal mortality is 45% down since 1990. HIV, TB, malaria all see major reductions in new infections and in deaths. But we also have to acknowledge that many countries will not achieve the Millennium Development Goals. So much more action is needed.
The World Health Statistics 2014 surveys 194 countries. The data show women all over the world live longer than men, and the gaps in life expectancy between rich and poor countries persist. It says declining tobacco use is a key factor in helping people live longer in several countries. The top six countries where life expectancy from birth has increased the most are Liberia, Ethiopia, Maldives, Cambodia, Timor-Leste, and Rwanda. The report cites Iceland as the top-ranked country for life expectancy among men, which is just over 81 years. Japan comes out on top for women who live until age 87. On the bottom of the scale, the report finds life expectancy for both men and women is still less than 55 years in 9 sub-Saharan countries. Dr. Boerma tells VOA spectacular progress has been made in countries where strong government leadership promotes health and health services.
One lesson, though, is that if the political unstable situation resolves, we've seen in many countries a catch-up. Really fast progress. Examples, Liberia, which is now our fastest progress country, Rwanda, but also Cambodia.
Dr. Boerma notes such practices as good delivery care for women, family planning, and immunizations are aiding the progress. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with handball. Angola's Petro Atletico aimed to win an unprecedented 7th consecutive women's title when the Africa Club Handball Cup Winners' Cup gets underway in Oyo, the Republic of Congo, today, Friday. Egypt's El Ahly seek to retain the men's trophy at this 10-day contest. Turning to football, Sudan's El Hilal hosts the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe in Orange Africa Champions League action today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Tunisia's Esperance play Algeria's Entente Setif, while on Sunday, Tunisia's CS Sfaxien engage Libya's El Ahly Benghazi as the Democratic Republic of Congo's AS Vita tackles Egypt's Zamalek. Elsewhere, Mali's AS Real de Bamako host Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa as Egypt's El Ahly welcome Zambia's Nkana in Orange Africa Confederations Cup mini-league action tomorrow Saturday. Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports face Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel on Sunday, while a new date will be set for the clash between the Republic of Congo's AC Leopards and Cameroon's Cotton Sport. Meanwhile, South Africa hosts Ghana in a women's friendly match in Soweto on Sunday. Both teams are preparing for the Africa Women's Championship qualifiers next week. In athletics, Namibian sprinter Jesse Urikob is hungry for more international success following his 100-meter and 200-meter triumph at the recent South Africa Open Athletics Championships in Tlokwe. He reckons this is the start of many good things to come.
Yes, I'm very happy. It's been a good week for me. It is a person in the 100, so yeah, I'm very happy.
What is your plan going forward?
My plan is to reach the semi-finals in the Commonwealth Games, both 100 and 200 meters.
Okay, and then the Africa Championship?
I hope to win a medal at the African Championship.
That was Namibia's Jesse Urikob, the South Africa Open 100-meter and 200-meter champion, speaking in Tlokwe, Northwest Province, South Africa. Meanwhile, the IAAF World Challenge Series is set for Ponce in Puerto Rico tomorrow, Saturday. The IAAF Diamond League is expected to take center stage in Shanghai, China on Sunday. Elsewhere, Ethiopian multiple world record holder Kenenisa Bekele and Kenyan world marathon record holder Wilson Kipsang face off at the Great Manchester 10-kilometer run in Britain, while the MTN Kigali Peace Marathon will be contested in the Rwanda capital on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you on Monday. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, May 16th.
As the waiting world commence a search for the adopted students in Nigeria, I wish to launch a passionate appeal to the Muslims, those confined that go to the mosques today, and Christians that go to churches tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday, to pray fervently for a fast recovery of the adopted girls. And God will bless you. Prince John is here in Obaniku, Obodu Cattle Ranch, Cross River State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. There are conflicting reports about whether Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan on Friday will visit a northeastern town where Islamist militants last month seized more than 200 schoolgirls. Senior government officials told reporters Thursday that Mr. Jonathan will travel to Chibok in Borno province before leaving to attend a meeting in Paris. But later, the coordinator of Nigeria's National Information Center, Mike Umeri, told VOA that report is not accurate. A court in Sudan has sentenced a pregnant woman to death by hanging for refusing to renounce her Christian faith. 27-year-old Mariam Yahya Ibrahim, who is already the mother of a 20-month-old son, was convicted on Sunday and given 4 days to abandon her faith. And that is it for this Friday, May 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mike Ullman, along with our engineer Nestron Kali, I'm James Butte saying have a lovely weekend.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.